This is the Financial Sense News Hour with the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. And now, our lifetime income experts, Jim Poplava and Kathleen Harris.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income. Coming up later on in the program, we're going to be talking to Ben Kwan from Stradling, Yoka, Carlson, and Roth. He's going to be talking about business structuring. Should you have a subchapter S corporation, a C corporation, or an LLC, and what the differences are in terms of liability, taxation, and how they function?
And I'm Kathleen Harris. This week we'll be talking about a group we lovingly call here in the office the Doomsday Preppers. We've heard a lot on cable channels about people who are prepping for doomsday by saving food, saving money, gathering firearms. Well, we've got investors who do essentially the same thing with their portfolios. So today we'll be talking to people who are preparing their portfolios for either a dollar crash or a market crash or both, and talk about how the situation in Cyprus is giving us some lessons we need these people to pay attention to when they think about whether or not their portfolio truly is prepped for what they think might be coming.
Well, I would say, Kathleen, one of the common portfolio strategies that we see across the board are probably two and maybe three asset categories. You have larger concentrations of cash because you're worried about a stock market crash or a dollar crash. And the other asset is you might have a large concentration of gold. So I think the worst is going to come. One of the common questions we get here on the program on the weekend is a dollar crash, a stock market crash. So people are all in gold in cash, or even worse, they may be all in bonds. But typically, those are the three assets that we see in these what I call doomsday or crash portfolios. High concentrations of cash, high concentrations of gold, or all in bonds.
And Jim, we have to say we completely understand what's driving this desire to structure your portfolio this way. We know that people have been hit hard by the crash that happened in 2000, 2001. They got hit hard again in 2008. There's a lot of craziness going on with money printing. We understand the impulse to make a portfolio that's heavy in cash and heavy in gold. But there are some pros and cons of doing so, which we're going to cover in a little bit in the program. Jim, you mentioned one of the things that's common in these portfolios is a high concentration in cash. What does the situation in Cyprus tell us or teach us about having a high concentration of cash in your portfolio?
Well, there's two things. I'm not doing the weekend program, but one of the things that struck me, Kathleen, about Cyprus is there's two outcomes from Cyprus. Number one is the rule of contract law. So, for example, if I put money in a bank and I have deposit insurance of $100,000, I am basing that trust of putting that money in that financial institution on contract law, that the government in the financial institution is going to honor my $100,000 deposit or up to $100,000 deposit. Now, if the government can come in and say, well, we're really not honoring deposit insurance, we're going to call it a tax, whatever you're calling it, you are breaking contract law, and you tend to find this in a lot of what I call third world countries. This is something that Argentina did back at the beginning of the last decade when they confiscated bank accounts and went after pensions. And so that's one thing that should really stand out and give a moment of pause to people that have large amounts of concentration in cash, because when governments get desperate, in this case, whether it's Argentina in 2001 or it's Cyprus in 2013, they look for ways to get at assets that they're not getting in tax revenues. So that is one lesson. And you've seen it in numerous countries. Argentina, as I mentioned, Cyprus, North Korea. The worst asset to be in during times of extreme financial crisis could be bonds. Because what happened in Argentina, what happened in Europe during the Greek crisis, you had Greek bond yields go from 6 and 7%, Kathleen, all the way down, all the way up to 30%. They're still at 10% today. So when a country gets into a financial crisis, there's two things you usually see. Number one, interest rates skyrocket, the currency collapses, and as the currency collapses, interest rates skyrocket. So if you're in bonds in that country in a crisis, what's going to happen is you're going to lose a lot of money in the bond market, and that's exactly what's happened. We've seen it happen in the last couple of years in Europe with the pig countries. I don't care if you're looking at Greece, Italy, Spain, Portugal, Ireland, all of those countries, and now we're seeing it in Cyprus, and we've seen it in Argentina. So the worst area that you want to have your money in is the area that people are putting their money in now, expecting this doomsday scenario.
And Jim, like we mentioned, we completely understand this impulse. But again, you take the risk of confiscation if your money is in bank accounts. It's happened several times throughout world history. It's a bad place to be in case something happens. Let's talk a little bit toward the person that's really heavily invested in gold or silver, really exposed to precious metals. Let's just take a scenario, Jim, walk our listeners through. What would happen if the worst came to pass and the dollar collapsed? What would happen to the investment markets after that happened, Jim? What would the investment world look like if the dollar truly were to collapse?
Well, there's two things. If the dollar were to collapse, and if we take any of those currencies around the globe, whether it was the Argentine peso or Zimbabwe, the first thing that happens is assets that have a tangible value. That's farm, that's commodities, and it's stocks. Because if you own a stock, you own a percentage ownership in a business. Every single one of those scenarios throughout history, we've seen an increase in the nominal value of stocks. And probably at the extreme, Kathleen, is we can take Germany during the 1920s when they experienced hyperinflation. Their stock market went up by millions, and I'm saying millions percent. If we fast forward here into this decade of Zimbabwe, one way you maintain purchasing power was in the stock market. So if the dollar was to crash, you would see stock prices go up, as we did in Argentina, as we did in Russia, as we did in Turkey, as we did in Zimbabwe. All of these countries that have experienced a currency collapse or a severe decline in the value of their currency. In gold terms, gold prices would also go up. But here's a big difference. Governments look differently at gold than they do stocks. And if you take a look at the capital gains rate, the capital gains rate is much higher on gold than it is stocks, depending on where you are. Let's say, for example, you have income underneath $450,000 or $400,000 as a single individual. You're still under the old Bush capital gains tax rates, which can be as low as 10%. That is not the case with bullion. And what we've seen with a valuable asset, with gold, in the case of our own government, we've actually confiscated it. Now, I'm not saying that the U.S. government would confiscate it in the future, but they could do it indirectly through taxation. We already have a 28% tax rate on gold. Add to that, if you're in the state of California, you could pay up to 13.3. So you're already talking over 40% as it stands right now. But what if they add a windfall profits tax, as they did to the oil companies in the 70s, and those windfall profits tax remained in place well into the 80s, and I think it was Ronald Reagan that got rid of the windfall profits tax in his second term of office. So the government would look unfavorably towards gold. They're not going to say to gold investors, gee, you guys were pretty smart while we were printing money and debasing the currency, and you've gotten rich through your gold investment. We're going to lower capital gains rate and make it very favorable. Governments are always predisposed towards financial assets, either stocks or bonds. So in a dollar crisis, Kathleen, what would happen is tangible type assets, real estate, stocks, gold. There is this misperception. If a currency collapses, the only asset going up is gold. And an example I can give you right now is if we go back to September of last year, when the Fed announced QE3 or QE Infinity, as it's now known, or in the case of December when they announced QE4, what has done best since QE? It's been the stock market, not the gold market.
Jim, I think this is a really important point to make because, again, we sort of have these doomsday or crash portfolios that are assuming when the dollar collapses that you won't want to be in stocks. And I think this goes back to how there's a misunderstanding of what a paper asset really is. I keep hearing investors call me and say, if the dollar collapses, I don't want to be in any paper assets, so sell my stock. And I think, Jim, that's part of the problem is that people don't really understand that a stock is not really a paper asset. Like you were mentioning, it's actually a tangible asset. True paper assets are cash and bonds. So again, if you're thinking about prepping for the dollar crash, one of the worst places to put your money is in cash or in those bonds. But stocks are not the worst place to put your money. In fact, they're a good place to put your money in case of a crash.
Well, a good example is if we go back to 2008, Kathleen, the CPI is up 15%. And let's just take the government's CPI numbers at face value. I know others think that the inflation rate is much higher, but CPI has gone up 15%. The dollar has lost 10% of its value. So if you've been in cash, your cash today has 25% less purchasing power than it did back in 2008. Now, if we look at asset classes, if you were in bonds, you did okay. You didn't lose money. You know, the income on your bonds have gone down since, and I'm referring to bond funds here because that's where most people are putting their money. But Kathleen, the stock market is up close to 140%. So here we have an asset that is responding to inflationary pressures and to a devaluation of the dollar. The problem today, it's not just the dollar that's being devalued. All currencies are being devalued. So that's why we're seeing, in nominal terms, we've seen the stock market go up. And my argument would be that a 130% increase in the value of stocks is far above the depreciation of the dollar or depreciation as a result of inflation. So if you've been in stocks and you're up 130%, you've more than maintained your purchasing power. That is not the case if you've been in bonds or, in this case, cash.
And Jim, I think this is sort of why I get a lot of calls right now from people who are doing what I'm calling coming out of the bunker. They've been in the bunker for a long time. They've been holding their cash, holding their gold, waiting for the end of the financial world to happen. And time keeps passing, and the financial world hasn't ended. But they've been sitting on cash for this whole time. They've missed out on all the up movement in the stock market. So now they're out there, they've got all this cash, they want to do something with it, but they're not really sure what to do.
Well, you know, it's one of the problems that I see here, and you know more about this because you take a lot of these calls, and you see three types of investors that are coming out of cash now. The first kind is the investor that has unrealistic expectations. They want to go back to an investment world that existed at the time they went into cash 5 and 6 years ago. So it's almost like there's this time warp. And you get this, and you tell this to me all the time. You get calls and you go, you know what? I'm tired of being in cash for 5 or 6 years. I need to get a 6 and 7% rate of return. Well, if we go back to 2006 and 2007, when the Federal Reserve was raising interest rates, in 2007, I could have put somebody in a 2-year treasury note and they would have got a 5% return. I take that same 2-year treasury note, I can't even get them 0.25%. So the yield on a 2-year treasury note has dropped by over 95% since 2007. So the world, number one, we're dealing in a different world today. And more importantly, Kathleen, this is a global world. In 2000, in the bear market, we were able to move our clients into foreign bonds when the Fed was lowering interest rates, because the bond yields in Europe, in Canada, in Australia, Switzerland, France, Germany were much, much higher than the bond yields here in the U.S. And it was the Fed that was printing money while other central banks were keeping tight money. So the dollar was going down in value along with interest rates, while foreign currencies were maintaining their purchasing power against the dollar, and the interest rates were much higher. That is not the world we live in today. I can look at a bond screen, and it doesn't matter. Wherever I look around the globe, and Rob and I often talk about this on the program, bond yields are low all over the place. You know, they're 1.9% here in the U.S. on a 10-year treasury. They're less than 1.9 in the U.K. France, they're less than 2%. In Switzerland, they're less than 0.75%. In Japan, they're barely above 0.5%. There's no place around the globe that I can go to get these 6% and 7% returns that you're getting requests for. So the returns are different and the risk to reward ratio is much different. So that's the one kind of investor that we often come across, which is unrealistic expectations.
Jim, the second kind of investor I see that's been hiding in the investment bunker for a long time is someone who is really starting to feel the pain of being in cash. As you mentioned, they've watched their purchasing power decrease. They've also been noticing more and more the stock market going up while their money is making nearly 0% in CDs or wherever they have it. And so these people feel like, I've missed out on 130% uprun in the stock market. I need to make up for all that return I let go by being in cash. So I'm going to go out there and pick the highest risk investment I can to try to get the highest return I can to make up for what I lost by being in cash for all this time. And that's another unhealthy perspective because, again, we're just in a completely different market than we used to be. And I'm not sure that we can offer an investment, or anyone can, that can make up for 130% loss of potential return by being in cash for the last 5 years.
No. And the way you see this is they'll chase the highest dividend yield out there. And usually, if you're only going after the highest dividend yield, you better know what you're looking at. You better know the business plan, the business cycle, how this company performs in the business cycle. Why is that dividend yield high? Is that dividend in jeopardy? Are they paying out more in dividends than they're earning in terms of earnings, and also even more importantly than what they're taking in cash flow? And so you're right. It's the guy that says, gosh, I've been zero. Now I'm going to go for broke. I want to find the next Apple. I want to find the next super stock where I can double and triple. And I'm going to put all my chips on one color on the roulette wheel. And that's equally as dangerous because now they're getting more desperate. And what they're going to do is they're taking on an inordinate amount of risk and they don't realize it.
And then, Jim, it is kind of nice when I get a call from someone who is approaching this movement out of where they've been in cash and gold with a more rational approach. Someone who says to me, okay, I know I've been heavily invested in precious metals and in cash for a long time, and it hasn't been working for me. So I'm willing to take on a more rational, realistic portfolio that's a little bit more diversified. There are people who are willing to consider going back in the stock market again with a portion of their portfolio, you know, between 50 and 60, maybe 70% of their portfolio, and have some exposure to bonds as well, maybe 20 to 30%, and then have an exposure to metal because we still think metal is a good inflation hedge, a good dollar hedge, and have a little bit in cash to buy when there's a dip in the market. So we do get some people, Jim, who are approaching this from a very rational standpoint and saying, okay, I've been wrong for 5 years, so I'm willing to try something a little bit different now.
You know what amazes me about this is, Kathleen, you're going through the CFP course. Anybody that has taken an investment course in college or is going for a certification in the investment field, and I don't care if you're a CFA, a CFP, one of the first things that they're going to tell you about is the importance of diversification. And there's a reason for that. I mean, we interview on this program some very smart people and people that are very diverse in terms of their opinions, in terms of what they think. We're in a bear market or we're in a bubble, the stock market's going higher, even technicians that we have in the program, which goes to show you, you know, here you have people that have been trained in technical analysis and they can look at a chart. And you can have two technicians look at that chart and walk away with two different conclusions. You'll have one that'll say, I think the stock market is going higher based on what I see. And then you have another one that'll say, no, I think we're at a top and we're going lower. So the important point is nobody is smart enough to predict where this market's going to be 1 year from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now. And this is something that I highlighted on the program last week. I'm reading Ben Graham's 1940 edition of security analysis. And this was his second edition. And this was 7 years after you wrote the first edition, which was in 1932, which was the bottom of the stock market. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 90%. And what Graham was saying, looking at the stock market and trying to become a good investor 7 years later, he was seeing increased government regulation that came in with the New Deal. He was seeing artificially suppressed interest rates with the Federal Reserve. He was seeing government intervention in the economy at all levels, whether it was through monetary policy, fiscal policy, or regulations. He was seeing the advent of inflation. And furthermore, at the time he wrote the 1940 edition, war had broken out in Europe. So what Graham was basically saying is, look, I can't predict if I'm looking at a company and I study their earnings. I can't say, well, they're going to make $1 a share this year in earnings. 5 years from now, I'm predicting those earnings are going to grow at 10% a year. And therefore, it's going to be $1.50 5 years from now. What I can do is diversify. What I can do is buy a dollar's worth of assets for 50 cents that gives me my margin of safety. And later on, this is one of Warren Buffett's favorite books, was The Intelligent Investor. So here Graham, writing in The Intelligent Investor several decades later, after he has had a lot more experience, 50 years experience in the market, he talks about having cash, diversification, as a better way to protect oneself against uncertainty, which is unpredictable.
So, Jim, given what Benjamin Graham was talking about in terms of the unpredictability of certain parts of the stock market, buying with a margin of safety, and the Buffett's approach to being invested in the stock market and quality companies, if I'm someone who's been in this crash-proof portfolio for a while, I've had my dollar assets there to prevent against a market crash. I've had my gold assets there to protect against a dollar crash. If I'm close to retirement or in retirement, what should I do to change my portfolio to make it be a little bit more balanced and be a little bit more productive for me as I move into my retirement years?
You know, if I was putting together a portfolio from scratch today, given those parameters, somebody that's, I don't know, 5-10 years away from retirement or in retirement itself, Kathleen, I'd probably have 10% in gold, because I do think currencies are being debased around the globe. Central banks are printing money. I would have 10% in cash. I would probably have 40% in a laddered bond portfolio with inflation index bonds, meaning that if interest rates rise or inflation, they would participate, and hybrid bonds, the same thing. And then I would have about 40% of my portfolio in dividend paying blue chip stocks. So that way, I've got a diversified portfolio. If we're in deflation, inflation, I have enough diversity between asset classes that if one area is not doing well, for example, the gold market right now or cash, that's not where I have all my money.
Part of this allocation you just outlined is a 10% allocation to cash. Now, we just got done talking about the risks to cash and how cash is a bad place to be during certain points in the market. Why would you be keeping 10% in cash right now?
Well, the one thing that we have seen, Kathleen, since 2009, we have climbed the proverbial wall of worry. We've had one crisis after another. 2010, it was a double dip recession. 2011, it was the debt ceiling debate. It was Europe. It was Greece, Fukushima. 2012, it was the fiscal cliff, the sequester this year. So we've had corrections. And one of the things that you always want to do is if the stock market corrects, you want to have some cash to take advantage of those things that you would like to buy at a lower price. You don't want to say, hey, I'm 100% fully invested. The market just corrected 10% and a stock I really want to own just got down to a level I think is an incredible buy. So you have that cash for that flexibility for emergencies or for opportunities. So you still want to keep cash. And Graham talked about that in a portfolio.
The other thing I want to talk to you about is bonds. You mentioned an allocation to bonds as being part of this portfolio. Can you explain a little bit more about that? Because we also mentioned that bonds are particularly vulnerable to currency issues as well. So why would you suggest being in bonds? And could you also address bond funds versus individual bonds as well?
Well, let's talk about having bonds, and we'll go back to a period of severe market duress, which was 2008 following the Lehman crisis. Kathleen, had you had this portfolio, and we've gone back and back tested, If you were in gold at the end of 2008, gold held up its value. It dipped short term, but by the end of the year, it held its value. The 10% in cash obviously would have not been disturbed. Now, the 40% you had, if let's say it was a laddered bond, as interest rates came down and the risk off trade dominated the financial markets as people looked for safety, your bond portfolio would have been up. On the other hand, your 40% in blue chip dividend paying stocks, that would have been down anywhere from 20 to 30% versus, let's say, the stock market that was down over 40%. So the idea is you don't know what the outcome is going to be 3 years or 5 years from now. Look at 2011, where we had a severe stock market correction between August and September as we were treated to nightly headlines that the U.S. could possibly default on its debt. It was a period that bonds did very well. It was also a period that the European crisis blew up with concerns about Greece exiting the euro. So money flowed into the dollar and flowed into bonds as it is doing right now with the crisis in Cyprus and also Japan's currency losing 18% since November. So you want to have some money in bonds, and we would do individual bonds because I have a definite maturity date. I can be more flexible in terms of my risk. I don't have dilution of income. And I also have an inflation protection. For example, if I have an inflation index bond, if interest rates go up or inflation goes up, then my rate of return is going to go up. So I'm protected.
So it sounds like, Jim, what you're suggesting is that let's just say I'm someone who has 50% in cash to hedge against market risk, 50% in gold to hedge against currency risk. You're suggesting, okay, take your gold position down to 10% and replace the other 40% of gold with 40% in high quality equities. That's going to be your currency crash, if that's how you're thinking. That's your currency crash hedge. And then with the other half of the portfolio, you're going to be invested instead of 50% in cash, take that down to 10% and put the other 40% into bonds. And that's your market crash protection. So you're still covering your currency crash and your market crash. You're just being a little bit more diversified and a little bit more rational with how you're approaching it, correct?
Yeah, exactly. Once again, nobody that I've had on this program or anybody I will have on this program in the future is smart enough to say, you know what, Jim, in the year 2015, this is where the stock market's going to be. This is where interest rates are going to be. This is where the dollar's going to be. This is where gold's going to be. Nobody is that smart. And this goes back to Ben Graham's philosophy. Now, those percentages I gave you, Kathleen, 10% gold, 10% cash, 40 bonds, 40% blue chip dividend paying stocks. I mean, you can play with those figures, you know, depending on a person's personality. They might want more than 10% gold. They might want to go maybe 15 or 20. But even people that I've had on this program that are, you know, in favor of gold and gold proponents like Dr. Mark Faber said he would have no more than 20% in gold. And yet we see people that have 60 and 70% in gold. Or they might want to have more than 10% in cash because they have future expenses. Maybe they want 20%. But I would say as a general framework, that's sort of like an ideal allocation, and you would probably have to modify that depending on what a person's income needs are, based on what a person's risk tolerance is. But I would say overall, that would be a general allocation framework to work with.
So sort of a rule of thumb starting point to develop your own particular portfolio, that some version of that, give or take a few percentage points here or there.
Exactly.
We started this program talking about many of our listeners out there that we have contact with who have what we've been jokingly calling a doomsday portfolio or an end of the financial market portfolio, mostly cash, mostly gold. We've talked about some of the downsides of having a portfolio allocated that way. And we've suggested that if you're looking for a portfolio that will still have the ability to stand up to a dollar crash and or a market crash, you can actually move out of those two very narrow areas of cash and gold to a laddered bond portfolio and some exposure to dividend paying stocks. And you'll have a portfolio that still performs well under those two circumstances, but has a lot more flexibility to take into account other circumstances that come to the market. And for those of you out there who listen, who are entrepreneurs or thinking about starting up a new business, coming up next on the program, Jim will be talking with Ben Kwan, who's, in addition to being an attorney, he's also a CPA, and he's the former vice chair of the California State Bar Committee on Partnerships and Limited Liability Corporations. So if you're out there wondering, I've got this business idea, I've been doing it for a while, do I incorporate it all? Do I do a C-Corp? Do I do an S-Corp? Ben and Jim are going to talk about the answers to those questions in the next segment of our program for Lifetime Income.
Joining me on the program today is Ben Kwan. He's a partner at Stradling, Yoka, and Carlson & Roth. And Ben, we've seen, let's say, over the last decade with the recession in 2001, the one that was in 2008, a lot of individuals have been laid off. A lot of them have turned out to become entrepreneurs. They've started their own companies. And, you know, people are familiar with the single sole proprietor. They're familiar with partnerships. But what I want to talk about today is taxation issues related to corporations, partnerships, limited liability companies. And let's start out with, okay, let's say I'm a single guy, a sole proprietor. And let's take that sole proprietor, the business expands all the way to a C-Corp. So let's begin with the sole proprietor, advantages, disadvantages from a legal perspective.
Well, an easy starting point is, of course, using a sole proprietorship. The issues are, of course, legal liability. If for whatever reason, the typical slip and fall with respect to your operations, if there's a lawsuit that arises, you could be liable to unlimited extent. The benefits of other types of business organizations are that your liability is limited, so you could protect your assets. So that is a major downfall for operating as a sole proprietorship.
So in this case, let's say I'm starting a skateboard company and I'm going to manufacture skateboards. Somebody gets my skateboard, they break their leg, they sue me. They could come after all my assets, including my home.
Right. They can go after your home, your car, whatever, your bank account. So it's a bit of a risky type of structure, albeit a simplistic structure.
Okay, let's say that my business is doing well. We'll stick with the skateboard company here as an example. And I have a friend that wants to provide some capital, help me expand the business, and he wants to become a partner. So let's move on to now, from a sole proprietor, I now have a partner or a couple partners.
So if you have additional partners, you are now a glorified partnership. If you don't file any documents with the Secretary of State, you're in essence a general partnership, and you face the same unlimited liability with respect to any lawsuits that relate to your operations. So a lot of people who come together in partnerships, either they form a limited partnership or they form an LLC, which are treated the same for tax purposes.
I want to move that because we've heard a lot about LLCs. Can you describe what it is and what the advantages are and why so many people are using that form?
Well, you can think of an LLC as an entity that's comparable to a corporation in that for corporate liability purposes, it's actually a separate legal entity. And if there are any liabilities that arise with respect to your business operations, be it trade payables or lawsuits, they can only go after the assets of the entity. So that's the major benefit of the LLC. But the downside, of course, is it has a bit of more formality than a sole proprietorship or a general partnership because you have to make Secretary of State filings. There's an $800 annual fee if you're in California. And you've got to file a partnership tax return. So there are a lot more hoops to jump through if you're an LLC.
You know, I know that President Bush, when he became president and we went through the Bush tax cuts, a lot of tax experts advised individuals to form subchapter S corporations. In fact, many people that had C corps converted to subchapter S. Explain why they would do that and the advantages of a sub-S versus a C.
Well, the sub-S is a flow-through entity, meaning that the entity itself is not, in general, subject to taxation. So it brings a C-corporation more in line to an LLC or other type of partnership because you're avoiding an entity level of taxation. Like backing up, if you operate as a C-corporation, it's actually a separate taxable entity that has to pay its own taxes. And then any dividends that come up to its shareholders are subject to tax again. So there's a double taxation. But you avoid that by making an S-corporation election. And so you eliminate the corporate level tax. So it is tax advantageous to be an S-corp as opposed to being a C-corp.
Now, what about some of the liability issues with the sub-S? Let's say the sub-S has, since it's a flow-through entity, let's say it has assets of, I don't know, let's just say $100,000, and it's owned by an individual, but he decides that he wants a sub-S. Could that individual take the $100,000 out of the sub-S and just put it into his personal account if he was the owner of the sub-S?
Oh, yes, he can, because that person is the sole shareholder, and he or she can cause the sub-S entity to make a distribution to him. And a lot of times those distributions are tax-free. So it's a pretty easy transaction to enter into.
So even though we've seen higher tax rates go into effect as a result of the fiscal cliff, many individuals that are still under that $450,000, I believe is the figure for a married couple, $400,000 single, still may be in the old Bush tax rates, so the subchapter S may still be more favorable than a C-Corp.
In any event, the S-Corp would be more favorable than the C-Corp because the tax law changes that came about as a result of the fiscal cliff. It, mm-hmm. it raised the individual tax rates for certain income thresholds, but it didn't affect the 35% tax rate for corporations. So whatever money that the C-Corporation makes, it's subject to 35% tax. And then when you distribute that money out to the shareholders, that's when the shareholders could be potentially benefiting from the lower Bush tax rates, assuming that they're below the income thresholds.
Now, it's my understanding, Ben, that if I have a C-Corp, and I keep thinking of Warren Buffett, Berkshire Hathaway, that has built up one of the most valuable companies in the world. And one of the ways that he likes to invest in companies that generate cash flow, or if he's buying public companies, he likes companies that pay dividends like Coca-Cola, because a C-Corp that invests in the stock of another public company, isn't there an exclusion from taxation?
Right. There's a dividends received deduction where if you have a C-Corp that holds shares, a sufficient number of shares in a subsidiary investment corporation, that all or a portion of the dividends are received by the investing corporation on a tax-free basis. The reason is because if you have a C-Corp portfolio company, it's paying tax, and then the money comes up and the C-Corporation on top is paying tax again. So you don't want multiple levels of tax on the same income. So in effect, they're making it so that you're not taxed too many times.
Now, let's go back to my skateboard company. We are now becoming large enough where we're going to, let's say we have a plant here in San Diego, but we're also thinking, boy, we ought to build another one in Florida because there are a lot of people skateboarding in Florida. So now we're going to build a second plant. We're going to have to raise capital. Why is it most public companies you see are C-Corps?
Oh, they're always C-Corps. If you had even if you were, for example, a partnership,
mm-hmm.
if your interests are publicly traded, the partnership becomes taxed as a C-Corp in any event. So you haven't really changed it. You haven't derived any benefit from being an LLC. And investors are used to seeing the investment vehicle being a C-Corporation. So if your desire is to go into the public markets to access capital, then you'll always be a C-Corporation. So that is the main benefit of why you would choose to be a C-Corporation.
Let me ask you, going back to the liability issue. Okay, a limited liability corp limits the liability to the corporation. Explain the corporate liability between an LLC and just a regular C-Corp.
They're identical, actually, because if you have an entity that provides for limited liability under corporate law, be it an LLC or a C-Corporation or even an S-Corporation, any type of corporate form, your liability is just limited to the amount of funds that you contributed into the operations. And because those are the only assets that the C-Corporation or the LLC holds in its name, and those are the only assets that a creditor can go after. That's why it's limited liability.
So if you do have a subchapter S-Corporation, and let's say you're building accumulated income, you would want to take those assets and invest in personally to eliminate or minimize the liability, would you not?
Exactly. You'd probably want to pull the cash out, and then those proceeds would no longer be subject to the claims of the creditors of the S-Corporation.
Now, when you counsel individuals, take us through the steps of, let's say, an LLC, a sub-S, or a C-Corporation, assuming that we don't want to be a sole proprietorship because we want to avoid the liability. How would you counsel an individual? Let's go back to my skateboard company. We're doing pretty well. We're making a profit. We see ourselves expanding. What form of, let's say, incorporation or entity would I want to employ if I see myself growing?
Well, initially, we normally suggest startup companies to be an LLC because it has the tax advantage of being only subject to a single layer of tax compared to the corporation that's subject to 2 layers of tax. And it's easy to set up and operate, and it's just an efficient way of operating. The advantage of the C corporation, of course, is you can access public markets, but really that's probably an unrealistic goal in that there are very few public offerings being done of late, and access to the public markets is not really that easy. It's more likely that you have, for example, a private equity financing or venture capital financing, which may also necessitate being a C corporation, but you can always convert from an LLC to a C corporation on a future date on a tax-free basis. So by being initially an LLC, you've got the flexibility of taking advantage of the tax provisions, of having limited liability, and having the option to always convert to a C corporation when and if you need it.
When you see companies like, it was a big issue, you take somebody, a company like Facebook, which, you know, was a multi-billion dollar company even before it went public. What was, do you think, the reasoning behind Mark Zuckerberg, let's say, avoiding, let's say, going public? Are there advantages when you get to be the size of a Facebook of not being a public company?
I think when Facebook finally went public, there was a lot of scrutiny on him. And whatever he said or did, not only in his public life and his personal life, it affected the perception of the company and the stock price. The stock price was actually very volatile, even several months after the initial IPO. And rather than facing those types of pressures, I think he might have felt better off just being a privately held corporation. I think the issue that really drove him to actually make a public filing was because the number of shareholders was so high that I think he was forced to become a publicly traded corporation and make all the attendant public filings.
And then now you have just the reverse. You have somebody like a Michael Dell, which was one of the top valued companies, let's say, before the bursting of the tech bubble. Now he wants to go private. So what's Dell wanting to do? Is he just saying, I don't want the scrutiny anymore, or I don't want to be subject to the whims of all the reporting requirements and the pressure put on me by analysts, Wall Street, and shareholders?
I think that's precisely it, that once you take your company private, then you only answer to yourself. You're the owner, and so you can sort of drive the vision of the company how you see fit. But when you're a publicly traded corporation, you've got a lot of people you have to answer to.
Yeah, you got to answer to Wall Street. You have to answer to the SEC.
To the board of directors.
Yeah, the board of directors. So are there other, let's say, tax advantages to incorporation? You know, we talked about if you're a C Corp, if you go out and invest in public companies and receive a dividend, as Berkshire Hathaway does, you can exclude those dividends from taxation or a good portion of it. Are there other tax advantages to incorporation?
Well, I just want to be clear about the tax advantage that Berkshire Hathaway is enjoying. The reason why the Berkshire Hathaway entity is not paying tax on that money is because the portfolio company which invested in paid corporate-level tax on those earnings. And it's just the dividend that's coming up is not being subject to taxation. Otherwise, it would be subject to corporate-level tax twice. So you're not really gaining anything. You're just paying corporate-level tax once. And when the money comes out of, first the money goes to Berkshire Hathaway, and then when Berkshire Hathaway distributes the money out to its shareholders, the shareholders have to pay a dividend-level tax. So nothing's being really gained by being a C corporation with the dividends received deduction. It's just imposing just one level of corporate tax. So from a tax perspective, it's not a very tax-friendly structure to begin with. It's really mainly driven by the desire to access public markets. And the only exception to that is there is this little-known tax code provision called the Qualified Small Business Stock. And basically, this is a provision that's been in the code, I believe, since 1993, let's say, if you can coin the phrase, supersized, in that initially it provided a 50% exclusion from tax on your gains for stock in a qualified small business company. But when Obama came into office, he increased the exclusion to 100%. So basically, you could invest in a qualified small business and reap millions of dollars and not pay any tax on it as a shareholder. The entity itself would still pay the corporate level tax on its income, but as a shareholder, you can dispose of your stock tax-free. So that's the only one benefit of being a C corporation, but that doesn't eliminate the corporate level tax. It's just you're eliminating the shareholder level tax. And in order to be qualified small business stock, there's a litany of requirements you need to meet, one of which is you have to hold a stock for 5 years, which is a pretty significant holding period.
Now, there has been some talk from the administration on a willingness to, in exchange for getting rid of deductions, lowering the corporate tax rate, because the U.S. now has the highest corporate tax rate, I believe. And correct me if I'm wrong on that. If corporate taxes, let's say the top tax rate right now is 39.6, plus you can add some tax on top of that with the exclusion of some of your itemized deductions.
For individual.
Yeah. So if the corporate tax rate goes down to, let's say, from 35 down to 28, and the income tax rate on individuals is 40%, would there be advantage to the C-Corp then?
Of having operating a C-Corp. But the thing is, even though you've got a C-Corporation paying, let's say hypothetically, 28%, at some point in time, those earnings are going to be distributed out to the shareholders and then subject to the whatever the individual tax rate is at that time, 40%, 39%. The lowering of the corporate tax rate doesn't provide any benefit because it's a double level of taxation. You're paying tax at the corporate level, and then you're paying tax at the shareholder level at the individual rates. So there really is no advantage in that sense. The real advantages that you could try to obtain is if you have international operations, you can set up a corporation in a tax haven jurisdiction, and you can sort of play within the tax rules of deferring U.S. taxation. But I think that's pretty much beyond the scope of this discussion.
Yeah, well, let's take my skateboard company. Now we decide that there's a big demand for skateboards in China, Japan, and Asia. So I want to set up a foreign manufacturing operation somewhere in China or maybe Japan to manufacture skateboards for Asia, because we have heard, Ben, that, and we've seen this discussed politically, that corporations are sitting on, you know, maybe $2 trillion of cash offshore that the government has never taxed.
Right, because there are these antiquated tax rules that came in during the Kennedy administration. And basically, if you structure your operations in a certain manner and you don't bring the cash back into the United States, you never pay U.S. tax on it. You basically are only paying local tax. So if you form your entity in a tax haven jurisdiction that imposes a low tax rate, then you're paying very little local taxes. You never pay any U.S. taxes, but you got to keep the cash offshore. As soon as the cash comes in general, it's subject to U.S. taxation. But there have been what's called tax holidays. Previous government administrations have offered this what's called a tax holiday, and that they allow you to bring that cash back into the United States and only subject a small portion to U.S. taxation. The intent being, by bringing that cash back into the United States, it's going to spur the economy. So that's always a possibility.
So as we conclude, Ben, here, if, let's say, our listeners, there's somebody out there that is operating as a business or they're thinking of starting a business, if they were to come into your office, what are the kind of things that you advise them? What would be the kind of things you would want them to start thinking about in terms of making a decision, whether they're, you know, a partnership, sole proprietor, sub S, LLC, or C?
I think you need to look at it from a holistic approach, not just tax, but corporate law as well and securities laws as well. What is your current need today and what are your expected needs in the future? If you're just going to be a successful small business that's just starting out, then I don't think there's any need to be fancy and focus on a complicated structure. You should just be a simple LLC, and then you can always transform your structure later when and as needed. But you want to think about, initially you're going to think about cost of your structure, whether you need access to capital markets, your sensitivity to legal liability. There are a number of factors that are considered, but in general, I always suggest a startup company to be an LLC because it's simple to create, it's cost effective, and there are low taxes that apply.
Well, Ben, your firm does a lot of work in the corporate area. As we close, if our listeners would like to find out more about the work that your firm does, do you have a website that you could give out or a phone number?
It's www.sycr.com. That's Stradling Yaka Carlson Ralph. And my number, please feel free to call me whenever you like. It's 949-725-4165. And I'm happy to answer any questions you have regarding your business operations.
Well, we've been talking with Ben Kwan, and once again, Ben's website is www.sycr.com. Ben, I would like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income.
Thank you.
Well, Kathleen, that ends this week's program. A lot more topics we're going to be covering in the weeks ahead, including Medicare fraud, reverse mortgages. That seems to be a question that keeps coming up. Of course, maybe it's the evening news commercials where we see so many of these movie stars that are recommending the program. We have the head of the Reverse Mortgage Association coming up in the weeks ahead. We'll also have more issues regarding estate taxes. And we're going to talk about a topic. What if you are one of those fortunate Americans where you have an estate large enough that could be subject to estate taxes? Well, believe me, we're going to be talking about ways that you can shelter your income, because why do we have couples today or families like the Kennedys that still have a fortune when tax rates were as high as 70%? You're going to want to listen in as we talk about ways to shelter and protect your estate. Let's put it this way. When Jackie Kennedy passed on several years ago, she passed on a $200 million estate to her children, with only $1 to $2 million in shrinkage in that estate. How did Jackie Kennedy do that? And how do we have families like the Rockefellers around where we've had large estate taxes and lower exemptions than what we have today? We're going to talk about that in the weeks ahead. In the meantime, on behalf of Kathleen and myself, Jim Poplava, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until we talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.